Thank you, Bud.
I think you're supposed to say that.
My name's Jack Sullivan, and I'm an alcoholic. I come from Louisville, Kentucky. If you've never been to Kentucky, it's noted for its beautiful women and fast race horses and smooth whiskey. And they have two out of the three there. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me. And I would especially like to thank those that they asked to host Gay and I. And, we spent a lovely weekend with Dan and Margie, and they've been so gracious to us and showed us your fair city. And we've just had a lovely time here. And I know it's a lot of work to put one of these things on, and I think the people deserve a tremendous debt of thanks that worked so hard to do this. Some people think, you know, there's really about three kinds of people in AA. There's people in AA that make things happen, and there's people that sit around and wondered what happened. Didn't even know anything happened. So, whatever category you fit in. If I can stay sober till Tuesday, and I'm not so sure that that can happen, I will have been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for the past 22 years. Now, that may not mean a damn thing to you, but it just impresses the hell out of me. A number of years ago, I was in a small town at Seymour, Indiana, and I had a friend celebrating 10 years in AA, and I went up to talk at the anniversary of her sobriety. And when I arrived, there was a young fellow there, about 21 years old, who had 3 months of sobriety, and he was going to chair that meeting. And he said to me, "I guess I'll screw it up." I said, "I doubt it very seriously. It's very difficult to screw up an AA meeting." He said, "Well, I'm nervous as hell." I said, "That's okay. You'll get over." So the meeting went on. It worked out real well. And when it was over, he said that he was glad that he got through it. But he said, "I did make a few mistakes," but he said, "maybe that has its advantages." He said, "I believe that the dumber the chairman is, the better the speaker looks." I certainly want to thank the committee for their selection. I should wind up giving one of the best damn talks I ever gave in my life, I think. I have a philosophy about speaking at an AA meeting. I'll try to stop talking when I'm through. Very sensitive. That microphone's about like these drunks, aren't they? Sensitive perfectionist. But I do, you know, I had a friend of mine one time was standing out in the hallway from a meeting, and some guy kept going on and on and on, and a guy came out and he said, "Isn't that guy through yet?" And the fellow said, "Hell, he was through a half hour ago, but he's still talking." And I'll try not to do that. And I also know that when I came in here tonight, I was going to be the speaker. I knew that. So I'm sure that when you came in here tonight, you knew you were going to listen. If you get through before I do, you go on home. I mean it. It won't bother me a bit. If you're through listening before I'm through talking, you go right on. Yeah. And as a speaker, you know, I'll share with you what I know about me and perhaps maybe what I've seen over the years, and I've seen a few things over the years, and The people that have crossed my path in the last 22 years have been a lot of interesting people, and they've taught me a whole lot, regardless of the outcome of their own personal situation. So I'm satisfied that when I leave here tonight, you will know at least a little something about me. And up till about a year ago, I had no way of knowing anything about the mentality of the audience that I was talking to. A doctor friend of mine gave me a story to tell that sort of evaluates your mentality. And I like to do that, and I'll share that story with you. There was a 91-year-old man who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And he was a bachelor. He'd never been married, had no children. He was sitting around his room one day, and he got to thinking that with his intelligence and dedication, that it was a shame that none of his genetic factors would be left on this earth. So he thought about it and decided he would make a trip down to the sperm bank. So at the age of 91, he went into the sperm bank about 9:30 in the morning, told the clinician who he was and what he wanted to do. She said, "Take this jar and go over in that little room and leave a deposit." So about 11:30 that morning, they were going to lunch, and the old man was still in there. So they went on to lunch, and they came back, and at 4:30, they were going to close the clinic, and he was still in there. So they knocked on the door and told him he'd have to come out, that the clinic was closing, and the old man came out and handed the nurse back the jar. And she looked at it, and she said, "Why, it's empty." He said, I know. He said, "I went in there and sat down. And he said, I tried my left hand on the damn thing for a while. He said, I tried my right hand on the damn thing for a while. He said, I run cold water on it. He said, I run hot water on it. And he said, I never could get the top off that jar." Well, that tells me what the hell kind of an audience I'm talking to. That lady down there was thinking nasty. I can obviously see you're not much better than I am. I never set out to become an alcoholic. It's nothing I've accomplished. From the time I was born until I was 13, I did quite well in the world. I don't recall having any apparent problems. I went to school and went to church, and I was a pretty good student, and I'm not real sure that I ever had any convictions about an organized religion or a God or anything else. I don't ever recall having any deep-seated feelings about those type of things, but nevertheless, up until that time in my life, I functioned and operated as a quote-unquote normal human being, whatever in the hell that means. When I got to be 14 years old, I went and enrolled in a high school in Louisville called St. Xavier High School, and as a freshman, I did fairly well, and when I was a sophomore at the age of 15, they asked me after I completed my sophomore year in that high school not to come back. And it was primarily because of my attitude towards most everything. Now, I'm sure that if there's some psychiatrists in this audience, you can fill psychiatric libraries as to why I began to act and react that way. And maybe someday you can tell me, because I sure as the hell don't know. But I do know that what I was taught at home and what I saw in that outside world were entirely two different worlds. And what I saw going on out there, I thoroughly enjoyed and loved and fell in love with that environment and that atmosphere. And I began to move in with an older crowd of people, and they were doing things that I hadn't been told about. And when I got out to that corner, they drank, and the racetrack was there. If you've ever seen the Kentucky Derby on television, it's the corner where I lived and died about 9 times. And if you watch the race on TV, you could even see some buildings in the distance over a starting gate, and that's where 4th and Central is located. And I went out there as a young man, and I really got wrapped up in that environment out there. There was girls and money and exciting things going on, and I wanted to be a part of it. And I immediately began to live my life doing what I wanted to do. I don't know why I made that decision. I have two sisters and a brother who did not make the same decision. My brother was a fool in a way. He studied. He's an industrial engineer with General Motors, a vice president with a corporation today. But that dummy, he missed out on all the fun. He was in there looking at books. So I went to the corner, and the corner was fun. And I had admiration for people that had Continentals and $100 bills and good-looking girls. And that's what the hell it was all about. And that's what I wanted. And I began to live that life doing what I wanted to do. You know, I tell people all the time, I lived and died with an I syndrome. I made my own decisions. I decided what I wanted to do. I don't need you. I don't need God. I don't need anybody. I'll do it. And when I came into AA, I was very argumentative with AA, and I think it was because the very first word they said to me was we. The first word of the first step is we. Alcoholics aren't we people. I never met a damn alcoholic. It was a we person in my life. Now, they're I people. I'll do what I want to do. And I never, until I came to this program, could get my life straightened out to where I did what I needed to do with the help of others. And when I started living this way, man, it was an exciting life. I went out there and jumped right into it, and I got to drinking, and I'm not real sure the drinking was a problem at that time. I had beer and that type of thing. And I got into that racetrack environment where the gambling and the money was, and I just fell in love with it. And I met a young lady out there, and she took me from soprano to baritone, and I thought this is about the most exciting game that I've ever gotten into, and I jumped right in, and I loved it. My mother died when I was about 17 years old, and the only one left to except the burden of this responsibility was my father. My father was very critical of the way I was living, and naturally any parent would have been. My father, like any parent, tried to interject discipline into my life because he loved me. Parents don't do that to deny children of anything. They do it because they love them. My father was trying to protect me from getting hurt. My father wanted me to be able to see and enjoy what love meant. You see, but even though many alcoholics like me are starved for love, we settle for attention. We'll swap attention for love any day. And I wanted in that fast lane with that intent attention, even though my father was very critical of it. I loved things. I was the type of person that used people and loved things. I think that's where AA turns my life around. To where today I can love people and use things. But back then it was different. And my father did in the only way he knew how as a parent, to try to correct me and stop me and scream at me and threaten me and all the things that a good parent would do. But at the same time, my father was a very strong man. My father was a firm believer that if you dance to the music, you pay the fiddler. I will not pay for you. And I was even at the age of 18 or 19 then, even into that big macho attitude that alcoholics have that, you know, I'm in there, I don't need anything or anybody. I'm really a wheel, a cool cat, an operator, whatever the hell you want to call it. And the fascinating thing that I was about to enter a phase for the next 13 years to where I would try to be scared into not progressing in alcoholism. You can't scare alcoholics with threats of the consequences of drinking. You know, it's a fascinating thing about alcoholics. Alcoholics are not afraid of anything that'll kill them, but they're scared to death of anything that'll help them. As if they're not afraid of death, but yet afraid of life. They don't resent somebody that beats the hell out of them, but they resent somebody that tries to help them. And that fear that was within me was not of anything that was going to happen to me. It was the fear that perhaps maybe you might get to know me. And my father had to go through that emotional transition that wives and husbands and children do a great deal of time. You know, to have to sit and look at somebody and to love them for who they are, and in some sense of the word, hate them at the same time for what they are. That's got to be the most traumatic thing in the life of a person that I have personally never experienced, is to love somebody for who they are and at the same time hate them for what they are. And my father was beginning to look at this. And yet he believed, and he wasn't reluctant to say, my house, my rules, get out. You know, if you're so determined to be your own thing, then go be your own thing. If you dance, baby, you pay. My father knew a lot about AA and didn't know anything about it. You know, and there's a lot of parents that know what to do. They can't do it. My father was one who could. And I, with my smart tongue and arrogant manner and egotistical attitude that all alcoholics have, I got right in the middle of it, you know. And the only thing that ever toned me down was a squad car. You know, really and truly, humility is in the back seat of a squad car. You know, probably the breeding ground of humility is in the back seat of a squad car. And if you don't believe that, check it out sometime. Did you ever stand in a bar and listen to all us big macho people talk about whoever in hell it is we're talking about? Did you ever some guy talk about that old bitch he lives with and the people he works for? In my case, that dumb old man, you know, and a big tough macho crap, all these things these people are doing to us and causing us and everything. Lock him up. Go down to the police station and listen. They give you a quarter for one telephone call and drop it in the phone. That old bitch he talked about at the bar, she'll answer. And that big, tough, macho alcoholic, he says, honey, honey. And when I threw that dime in the slot back there, and my dad answered the phone, you know, and all that garbage I'd been putting out about him, and he came to the other end, and I said, Daddy. And to show you what kind of man my father was, he said, what? I said, well, I'm in jail. He said, why did you call me? I said, well, I thought you might come get me out. Oh, he said, I wouldn't worry about that if I was you. Why, he said, as smart as you are? Oh. He said, hell, if you figured a way to get in, you'll figure a way to get out. And hung up. When I got out, he said, don't waste your dime on me anymore. And that's just exactly the way that he felt. You can read any book on alcoholism and you'll find me as a single, progressive alcoholic. Now, I never married until I came into AA. This lovely lady sitting here with me tonight is my wife. And I married Gay on September the 7th of 1963, 13 months after I was sober. She's not too bright either. She divorced an alcoholic that drove her crazy and married me. So it was two unbright people, I guess. So I didn't have a family or women. I never wanted to get married and I was drinking. I don't know what in the hell people got married for. I don't know what in the hell they wanted with a wife. It seemed to me like they slowed everybody down, you know. When you get in that, I mean, it might have added a little dimension of responsibility that might have slowed me down. I don't know, but I never entered my mind to get one. I didn't know what in the hell you did with them. I wasn't done. And what in the hell you kept them for, I didn't know. And as I told my sponsor, most of the women that I ran with weren't the marrying kind. And he looked at me and said, what in the hell were they going to get? Most of them were real ugly. I used to run. I ran with some ugly women. I went with this one, and she went home one night and started undress. She went in the bedroom, and she was undressing, and a peeping Tom came up to the window. And when she got about half undressed, he reached in and pulled the blind down. Now, there were certain people that were about to enter my life, I'm sure, as they entered into the lives of entered into your life, who back then knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. I'm satisfied they were well-meaning people. In their own uneducated way of being ignorant, I guess, in the field of alcoholism, they thought that the solution to people like me was to threat and warn you of obvious things that you already know. There was a Monsignor in a Catholic church up home that was a good friend of our families, and he decided to take me on. I've often said when I came in AA and they asked me to surrender, I thought, hell, it's about my turn. You know, I had a hell of a lot of people surrender to me. They gave up in a hurry. But, you know, this priest, he really thought the solution to alcoholism was a seat in the sanctuary, Bible in your hand, a pat on the head, and come back in the morning. You know, or spray you with holy water and you'd be all right, you know. And he really believed that, and he tried that with me, and telling me that if I didn't change my ways and if I didn't do this, I was going to hell. Another threat. Scare him into not progressing. And he thought he had done a great job on me because I think I stayed sober about 48 hours. And he considered that a success until one day I come through the Holy Name schoolyard, said drunk, I was bouncing off a building, and he surrendered. He came to me and he looked at me and he said, you're a hopeless drunk. And at that time I was. You know, I know the definition of hope. You know, somebody that possesses hope, you really believe you'll succeed tomorrow where you failed today. You reach a point in your life in this sickness to where you understand and realize things will never be any better. They will be like they are. And I think you do become hopeless. But he looked at me and he said I was hopeless. Then he informed me that him and I would meet on the way to heaven. Then he told me when you generally meet somebody, you're going one way and they're going the other. And he just turned around and walked off. And he underestimated us in our line of thinking and our egotism. As he headed back to that rectory, I looked at him and I thought, I wonder what the hell he's done. He was so well thought of around there. And, you know, he was a good preacher, I guess. I've heard him a few times in the pulpit. I don't think he was using it. You ever hear that story about that dynamic preacher and that young preacher? He couldn't talk very well, and he finally asked the old one what he did, and he said, well, don't let anybody in on it, but underneath that podium, that's not water, that's gin. He said, when you're preaching, take a few belts of gin. Really makes you dynamic. So the young preacher preached, and the old one went to hear him, and he said, how'd I do? And he said, well, you were better, but slow down on that gin. He said, David slew Goliath. He didn't stomp that son of a bitch to death. But anyway, I figured that he knew what he was talking about, I guess, and I was going to hell. There was a doctor in Louisville who is now a member of the program. In fact, I saw him the other day. And I was in the hospital one time in the late 50s suffering from all the things that alcoholics suffer from. And the doctor came in and he examined me and he saw that I probably had a little liver and hepatitis and malnutrition and all that kind of stuff. And I never forget my dad was sitting there in the room and he had not yet disowned me. He got around to that. But I recall Dr. Stanton coming in and looking at me, and he gave me a simple clarification. He said, if you don't stop drinking, you'll die. That simple. I know anything about alcoholism then, but I wished I had him. You know, I could have looked up at Dr. Baker, and I could have said to him, well, doctor, that's fine. If I quit drinking, I'll die. What happens if I do and can't live? You see, in my particular case, and in the case of most alcoholics I've ever known, that if they forced me into a life out there of not drinking, then they ordered me into an existence in a society that I wasn't comfortable in anyway. It's irregardless of who I am and where I come from or what elements were involved in my life. For some reason, when you placed me out there and asked me to accept the responsibilities and be whatever it was I was supposed to be, I just didn't fit into that square. I didn't belong where society said they would place me. So if I sit out there as an uncomfortable human being and an unhappy and discontented individual, trying to rely basically on myself and my own beliefs and ideas to survive in that jungle. I never was very successful at it. So if you condemn me to go out there without alcohol, you are condemning me to a life of an existence. I don't live in a society sober. I have never lived in a society sober. I can't start today. Either way, I'm a dead man. I'm dead without it, and I'm dead with it. The only thing with it brings is a lot of crazy, insane behavior. You see, irregardless of whether I took alcohol back out there with me, I had to take alcoholism back out there with me. And at that particular time in my life, my alcoholism was untreated. And untreated alcoholism without alcohol is a miserable, damned way to live. Given the choice tonight, I'd rather be drunk than have to live out there with untreated alcoholism. But I went back and tried for a while, and I couldn't succeed, naturally. So I took a drink, vowing it would be different, not believing that doctor, not really caring anyway. You know, I wasn't scared of the things that would kill me. I was just scared of the things that could help me. I didn't mind fooling with hoodlums, but I had absolutely no use for decent people. I didn't mind you telling me what you knew about me, but it was awful damned important to what I believed you didn't know about me. That's the image I had to protect. That's the wall I had to hide behind. That's the reason I could be so offensive, because then I would never have to become defensive. I drove you away from me because I was afraid of you. And you know, that's strange to me even tonight, that I wasn't afraid of a damn thing that would kill me. But God, I was scared to death of anything that could help me. But the doctor didn't bother me. You know, you heard it said, you don't scare an alcoholic, and you don't. You don't. I know a hell of a lot of people that have tried. We had one of them Al-Anons up here in Louisville one time. She went down to her costume shop and bought a devil's costume. And put it on, and her old man come home drunk that night, and she jumped out behind a hedge on him. And she said, "I've come to get you." And he said, "Who are you?" She said, "I am the devil." And he backed up about 2 foot, and he said, "Well, put her there." He said, "I've been wanting to meet you ever since I married your sister." You ain't gonna scare a drunk. We had an undertaker up home. His sister married an alcoholic. They tried everything in God's world to get him quit drinking. One night they buried him. Brought a coffin home, put him in it, took him out in the backyard when he passed out and buried him. Put a pipe down in there so he could breathe and get air. About 2 hours later, that old drunk come to in that coffin. Moaned, you know. "Where am I? Where am I?" They hollered down that pipe, said, "You're dead." He said, "Oh, my God." I said, "How long have I been dead?" And the guy said, "About an hour and a half." He said, "Who are you?" He said, "Oh, just a friend." He said, "Are you dead, too?" And the old undertaker said, "Yeah, I'm dead, too." The drunk said, "How long have you been dead?" He said, "Oh, I've been dead about 12 years. "Well," he said, "hell, if you've been drunk dead that long, you don't know where a guy get a drink around here." And that's about the attitude, you know. It's about the attitude. You sure to hell are not going to scare a drunk. I just progressed into the field of alcoholism. I went to work for the old L&N Railroad, now the Seaboard Railroad at that time, in 1940, as a young boy, 20 years old. I'm 55 now. And at the age of 32, they got rid of me. You know, talking about the railroad, I came to this convention feeling so good, and I got a resentment. I work in an alcohol and drug abuse program for the Seaboard Railroad, a lot like Jerry does for the N&W. And I was listening to Tony this morning, talking about that business she worked for, sending her to Hawaii. And my company sent me to Hazard, Kentucky to see a coal miner. I just resent the hell out of that. I want you to buy that tape and play it for my boss. But they finally got tired of me after numerous threats and warnings of losing a job law. And I ran into the police department, you know, you're going to jail, the judges, you're going to prison. All of these things these people were going to do to me if I didn't quit drinking, trying to stop my progression. And they had no information on alcoholism, and neither did I. I didn't know anything about it. Neither did they. And they tried in their way to help, and of course, to no avail. It was just a group of ignorant people dealing with something they had no idea what it was. They really and truly felt like that I enjoyed being what I was. My father had completely disowned me. He wanted nothing more to do with me. I had a sister that took me in one time and was trying to straighten me out, and she finally ran me off. And you know, I just didn't have anybody. Now, and that's an easy way to be an alcoholic, believe me. It's a hell of a lot easier to go out here and lay in a gutter than it is to get a gutter and take it home with you. Really, I mean that. I listened to Venetia and Tony this morning, you know, and they literally went and got their gutters and brought them home. And I've seen dirty, filthy gutters running down the middle of living rooms of $100,000 homes. And I've seen women and little children standing around these gutters, and the alcoholic in his sick mind, for some reason, has been able to muster a belief of his own that these people in some way are responsible for what he is and what he's become. And they sometimes make a very strenuous effort to grab the people that they should be loving the most into the gutter with them. To bring them down to where they are because of the feeling that the responsibility for what they are is somewhere connected to these people. And believe me, it's a hell of a lot easier just to leave and go into a gutter. You know, there's nothing real nice about living on city streets and in wino alleys in Haven. But it has its advantages. You know, the only disadvantage is a lot of times you get cold and you get hungry and things like that, but you don't have to be a phony anymore. Now, I feel sorry as hell for these executives and housewives and things that are alcoholics, and they have to go every day of their life pretending that everything's okay. Yeah. Just being phony as hell, but they have to pretend that everything's okay. And then to watch that torture aspect that this sickness seems to transport to the people that love you and surround you. And God, I don't think anything kills me any more in my life than to hear some damn alcoholic say that alcoholics are the only ones that know anything about alcoholism. Alcoholics are experts at vomiting. Outside of that, there's a hell of a lot of people that know a whole lot about alcoholism, and if you don't believe it, ask your wife. Ask your children if they know the feelings of insecurity. Ask them if they know what it means to be afraid. Ask them if they know what it means to be unloved. Ask them if they know what it means to feel like in some way they're responsible. Ask them if they have ever had these traumatic emotional experiences that you've had. And you'll soon begin to learn that they've not only had them, but they never even had the opportunity to bathe their brain in booze every once in a while so they could forget them. My father knew a hell of a lot about alcoholism because, you see, my father knew me. I'm not going to tell you my father understood me, but I am going to tell you that he knew me, and he knew a whole lot about alcoholism. I just went from a halfway decent type of a job. Hospital. Dr. Louis Fulce was famous psychiatrist. He was an advocate of AA. He treated alcoholism for alcoholism, and he loved AA. And he brought AA along with that administrator, and two guys brought that into that hospital on the same day that I went into that hospital. So the following week, I was feeling pretty good after a week, and a nurse came into the room that day, and they had moved me from a locked ward to an open ward. And she said, "Don't you go anywhere tonight. We're going to the AA meeting." And I said, "What the hell is an AA meeting?" I didn't know. Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, "Are you insinuating that you think I'm an alcoholic? And she said, I'm not insinuating a damn thing. I said, by God, I'm not an alcoholic. And she looked at me and said, if you ain't one, there ain't any. And that didn't go over too well. I said, I'm not going to any damned AA meeting. I came into AA motivated by a set of door keys. She looked at me and she says, you're going to that AA meeting, or, and she jingled them keys, we'll put you over there where the doorknobs are on the outside. And I said, well, I'll go. Kind of makes you feel like you're volunteering. So that night she came down and got me by the ear lobe and took me down that hallway to where those AA people were. And I didn't want to go. I hated the idea of going back there. I wasn't about to tell them I was an alcoholic because I was not about to accept the responsibilities of what was going on in my life. And I don't like the word alcoholic because it insinuates that I have a problem that I can't handle. And I have already told you I'll take care of everything. And for the strangest reasons unknown to God or man is the very fact that no matter how many pitfalls you get into in life, as soon as you get well and out of trouble and the noose off of your neck, you go right back to that line of thinking. Many times that alcohol brings on that euphoria, but that damn thinking brings on that belief in yourself, no matter what you've been through, and thoroughly convinced that the responsibility is those people out there. That doctor said, you're paranoid. I said, of course I'm paranoid. You would be too if they were out to get you. You know, who in the hell wouldn't be paranoid when they're all out to get you? And I didn't want to go back there. I'll take care of this. And it was madder than hell. He's having a square dance in the auditorium, and I wanted a square dance. Comes in handy when you're drinking. And I went back there, and I started in that door, and, you know, and I was ready for music and girls and booze again, you know, and there stood some damned old woman in that door, about 65 years old. She put her arm around me, and she said, hi, honey. Would you like a cup of coffee and a cookie? And I looked at that old broad, you know, and she had her arm around me, and I thought, hey, you know, I'm a worldly person. I've heard them stories about old women and young boys. I'm not a fool. A cup of coffee and a cookie. I went on in that meeting and sat down, interrupted the speaker as much as I could to tell and explain to him the things that he didn't know, and I wasn't damn interested in why he drank, and if he did, so what. I agreed that if he wasn't lying, anybody drank like he did ought to quit. But I knew that he didn't have the same justifiable reasons that I had. And I made a complete ass out of myself in that AA meeting. And I walked out that door, and there stood that old lady. And she put her arm around my shoulder again. And she said, honey, you come back next week now. We need you. I thought they ought to put her in a home somewhere. You know, get her off of the damn street. Yeah. I never got invited back anywhere. Yeah. And I sure the hell didn't want to join any club, have me for a member. Yeah. And I left. Yeah. Well, hell, they made me go back, and I argued with them, and argued with some old man back there, who I was blue in the face, who later became my sponsor. Yeah. He said, alcoholics have an extra bone in their body. All alcoholics have an extra bone, he said. It's right down here in your spine. He said, if you take any alcoholic you've ever known and kick him in the ass hard enough, that bone will vibrate and open up his mind. And he said, if you get an open mind, you might hear something. But most of all, if you can get an open mind, you might see something. You know, an open mind gives you the ability to see yourself for what you really are. And that's what's painful as hell, to see yourself for what you really are. Because as a practicing alcoholic, I was completely blind to what I was. Call it rationalization, call it perception, call it whatever you choose to call it. But I was blind as a bat to reality. A little minister reminded me of this, that I sometimes wonder when the Bible talks about Jesus making the blind man see, I wonder if that blind man had eyesight. Every alcoholic that's practicing out there is blind to the realities of life, blind to the realities of himself and what's going on in his life, and that as an individual he has no more the ability to control it or stop it or arrest it than a man in the moon. And by himself, he is not now or ever will be capable of living and surviving in that jungle based on what he knows and how he feels and his evaluation of life. That's what I couldn't see, and somebody had to make me see it. And that old man was determined as hell that whether I wanted to see it or not, I was going to. That's what a good sponsor is. I don't give a damn whether you want to see it. We don't care what you want. All your life you've lived doing what you want to do. And with all the power vested in me, I'm going to see to it that you start doing what you need to do. And that will allow you to see what in the hell you really are. And God, that hurts. That hurts. After 30 days, I was to be hurt more. They moved me to an insane asylum and put me on an alcoholic unit, the only one in the state of Kentucky, in a damn nut house. And that'll just shatter your ego. And especially when you walk through the grounds and the nuts are complaining because you're there. And sitting out on the benches saying, "Martha, what do you think of them drunks being down here now?" "Well, I don't like it. I don't know why they brought them here. A bunch of damn troublemakers is all they ever were. Wish they'd go away and leave us alone." You in trouble when insane people are talking about you like this. And we used to talk about them, and there was a bridge that went over a little creek there made out of slave rock. And a guy used to sit there day in and day out with his ear to that bridge. He went over a little creek. We used to talk about how crazy he was. I went by there one day and he said, "I went over." He said, "Listen, I got down on my hands and knees. I put my ear to the rock. And I said, 'I don't hear anything.' It's been like that all day." I'm running around telling everybody he's nuts. I left that hospital at the end of November of 1962 and went back to Louisville to live with my sister. My sister took me back into her home, and we had an understanding that if I started drinking, I'd leave. There was nothing ever between us except drinking. We had a good relationship then. We have one today. Me and her husband and children. And drinking was the only thing that ever separated that. She said, "You stay here until you can get your life back together. The only thing I'd ask you is if you take a drink, would you leave? I get absolutely no pleasure of asking you to." And I said, "Yes, if I do, I'll leave." And I believe that I would have. And I start going to the AA meetings. That old sponsor I had, he'd take you to one if you had a car and two if you didn't. Really. And then he would make you get up and tell people you didn't have a car and a way to get there. And you told him, "Joe was nice enough to bring me over here. I live out here off of Dixie Highway, and I don't have an automobile, and I need a ride home. And I'd like to go to some more meetings. If any of you guys go there during the week, I'd like to go. But I don't have any way to get there." He'd make you do that. And I'd do it, and I got rides. Yeah, and I start going to the AA meeting. I began to grow painfully. I did not believe in me. And I've already told you I believed in nothing else. I would like to be able to stand here and impress you upon the fact that I prayed, but I didn't. I didn't know how. And I didn't believe in God, and I didn't believe in you. You know, believing sometimes is words initially, I guess. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of feelings. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the language of the heart. The heart is a palace that stores all truth. If a famous clergyman was right, and I'll assume he was, if God is the intangible spirit of truth, and if man is the tangible spirit of truth, and if Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart, and if the heart is the palace that stores all truth, then I knew the truth about me. You see, I had no inner peace of soul when I knew the truth about me. I had no inner peace of soul when I had to look at you and you knew what and who I was. But most of all, in my own heart, I had no inner peace with me. I was not sure that I could do it, and I was scared to death because I was going to attempt something that made me get well. And I told you I wasn't afraid of a damn thing that would kill me. But God, I was terrified of something that could help me. And I sweated it out simply doing what that old man told me to do. I said, I don't know how to stay sober. He said, I didn't expect you to. I said, what do I do? I'm looking for some great complicated answer. He looked at me and winked. He said, you stick with me, kid, and you're going to be all right. You stick with me, kid. You're going to be all right. I stuck. I stayed with him. He was nasty and mean sometimes. You know, a psychiatrist up there told me that I was I'm a junior, John Sullivan Jr., really my name, the Jackson nickname. A psychiatrist told me I never had an identity. You were Johnny Sullivan's boy. That's why you drank. You never had an identity. And I thought that was the best damn news I had ever received. And I rushed back to the AA meeting to tell Hillary I had discovered why I never had an identity. I'm paying that doctor $100 an hour. Hillary looked at me and he said, God. He said, if you'd have been a grape picker in a Garden Eden, you'd have been a drunk. And that kind of blew my mind. And in sometime during that course of that year is when Gay and I met, and we started going together, and then finally in September of 63, we got married, and I'm satisfied that's what I needed, and also I was what she needed. And from that time on, it's her and everybody that's been involved in our lives have been blessing to us. And I finally, after a growth period that we all have where I believed in me and trusted you, I found the beliefs that made my heart still, my mind, my soul. You know, if the intangible spirit of truth is God, then I can accept that force that makes me a better person because that I do. You know, and what I'm trying to say to you, if you're new to AA, and like so many people, if you're agnostic or whatever, if you don't believe in God, if you don't have a relationship with a God, just remember it's not important. You see, it doesn't matter whether you love God. It only matters that He loves you. And when you find that, as AA people find it, with yourself and with people, you eventually find that. You have to find that. You see, because you can't live and operate in a spiritual community unless you're spiritually okay. You see, in any spiritual community, good and evil are polarized. We all have that opportunity. Anything polarized has a sense of direction to it. You have an opportunity to go in either direction. When you're here tonight, as new or old or whatever, 20 years or 20 days, you still have a free will given to you to make a decision tomorrow morning. Which direction do you want to go in? Do you want to go in what's good, or do you want to go in what's evil? Do you want to do what's best for you, or are you interested in satisfying your pleasures or whatever? You have to make that decision. A spiritual community allows you to make that decision. You are respected for your individuality, and collectively we put that together to help each other. But you have the respect of your own individuality and the right and the ability to choose. You soon find that in any spiritual community, There's no such thing as power. There's no power structures in Alcoholics Anonymous. Power couldn't stay in here very long. This entire program is based on principle. And principle connected with good has to bring about the type of feelings that we have in this program. It has to be. And then the greatest gift of all, which makes you automatically, whether you want to be or not, whether you choose to be or care to be, you automatically become one of God's children. When self-interest is not your primary concern. And in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, self-interest doesn't exist. The concern for others is the thing that feeds our own sobriety to make us the people we are. That is what a spiritual community is. And when you live in that, you have the feelings that Alcoholics Anonymous breeds from all aspects of it. Did you ever sit in a room by yourself when you knew that nobody was there but you and feel good? Did you ever sit in a room like this filled with people and feel good? Did you ever sit in a room and meditate and feel good? And all of the aspects of a spiritual life have come to you when you feel good about yourself, about people, and about God. And it's a feeling. It cannot be transported into words. It's an impossibility. Ask anybody that got drunk and they've lost the feeling. They haven't lost the knowledge. They know all the words. But they don't know the feeling. And they can't go out and bring it back sometime. It's a force of good or spirituality or call it whatever you want to. But it exists. And if you don't believe it, just listen. There's not a sound in this room. You couldn't cut the atmosphere of spiritual feelings with a knife. Whether you want it or not, it'll get you. If you have the smallest desire just to be something other than what you used to be. And that was all that I had, a desire not to be what I used to be. I had to be a smart aleck doing it. That's okay. I said to Hillary one night, he read that portion of chapter 5, and I said, just what in the hell is it that you have that I'm supposed to want? He looked at me and he said, well, how about a bed that's indoors? I couldn't argue with him. After about a year, I went back to work for the same company that I worked for. 9 years ago, I went in to started an alcohol and drug abuse program on the old L&N Railroad, and now with the Seaboard, and basically do the same thing Jerry does. I thoroughly enjoy working with people. And all I know about alcoholism is what you've taught me, what you and I know about each other. You know, I can share you and me and, you know, what I've seen, and that's all I believe anymore is what I've seen. You know, and I thank God for every human being that's ever crossed my path the last 22 years. Some are dead, some are paralyzed, some are in insane asylums, some are sober, some are even sober happy, some are contented, some of them are everywhere. But thank God they taught me something. I've never met a person who hasn't taught me something. And I love to share that with them. I'll close by telling you a story that a fellow told me a long time ago, and I've never forgotten it. And I close every AA talk I make with it. And I hope you remember it. It was about a man who was walking down a cold and lonely road one night, and a snake was laying in the middle of the road. And the snake was dying. He was freezing to death. And he spoke to the man. And he asked him, he said, Mister, would you please pick me up and put me under your coat and get me warm? I'm dying in this cold weather. And the man said, I couldn't do that. You're a poisonous reptile. And surely if I would warm you enough to restore you to vitality, you would bite me. And the snake said, I wouldn't bite you if you saved my life. And the man thought for a minute and picked him up and put him under his coat. And when he got him warm, the snake bit him. And he grabbed him out from under his coat and threw him back to the road. And he looked at him and he said, "I thought you promised not to bite." With a snickering grin on his face, the snake looked up. He said, "You knew what I was when you picked me up." And someday, my friend, under a given set of circumstances and conditions, you may be sitting in a bar stool or a cocktail hour or somewhere. Justify it to yourself if you choose. Explain it to those who don't know. If you've been here, if you know us, you know what it is when you pick it up. Thank you for having me in Virginia.